CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 178, with Dr. Richard Packard, the evolution of ophthalmic surgery over the course of many decades. How can we learn from the past to understand the future?
Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I've got a very special guest who's taught cataract surgery in phaco to, gosh, thousands of ophthalmologists over the course of many years, and that is Dr. Richard Packard. Welcome, my friend.
Hi, O'Day. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Oh, for sure. Now, I used to really spend a lot of time going through a lot of your teaching materials. Gosh, for many, many years, you've been really prolific in the way you've taught phaco.
Yes, I mean, I came to it in a way by chance. I was at Moorfields Eye Hospital as a resident, and I came 1978. I came out of there, and I needed a senior registrar job. And I'd heard about Eric Arnold and what he was up to, and I thought, oh, well, I'll go and have a word with Eric and see whether he'll take me on as senior registrar. All of the consultants, bar one, at Moorfields said, oh, you mustn't do that, Richard. It'll ruin your career. At that point in time, I had been expecting to be an ocular oncologist. Okay. I'd written my doctoral thesis on choroidal melanoma. And then I arrived at Charing Cross on December the 4th, 1978, never having seen a lens implant, knowing vaguely what phaco emulsification was, and there was a phaco and IOL course going on. I mean, this was my conversion for St. Paul on the road to Damascus. Suddenly, my whole life changed. And I decided I was going to be a phaco and IOL surgeon.
Wow. Which was very controversial at the time.
Oh, golly. There were virtually nobody in the UK, apart from Eric, and maybe one other person who was actually doing this. And he was the only one who was doing it on a regular basis. And IOLs also were very much not the done thing in the late 70s for most people in the UK. So I did my first IOL in December of 1978, not long after I arrived at Charing Cross. It was a Binkhorst lens. Sorry, not a Binkhorst, a Fedorov Mark I lens, which was a Binkhorst lens turned through 90 degrees. And then in January 79, I did my first phaco.
Wow. For the young people listening to our podcast, we have a lot of young ophthalmologists in 30s and 40s. People will used to call IOLs, quote, this is the quote, ticking time bomb in the eye.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were doing phaco, you were blacklisted.
Yep. Well, I went up for a job at St. Thomas's Hospital in London, which is where Ridley had been consultant, and also at Moorfields. And the senior guy there, John Winstanley, when I came to the main interview, first question he asked me is, Mr. Packard, he said, I hear you're interested in intraocular lenses. So I said, yes, Mr. Winstanley, that's right. I said, oh, thank you. And that was the end of the interview.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, I mean, you've got to put this into perspective. Ridley was doing something which was totally revolutionary, and it upset a huge number of people. He wasn't originally going to go public, but by chance, one of his implanted patients went to see an ophthalmologist called Mr. Ridley, but it was the wrong Mr. Ridley. It was Frederick Ridley instead of Harold Ridley. So the cat was now out of the bag, and Harold decided that he better do something about this. So he decided he was going to present at the Oxford Ophthalmological Congress in 1951. And he brought two of his patients who'd been implanted to the meeting in his Bentley and had them there with a slit lamp. And some people came and looked, but Sir Stuart Duke Elder was in the audience. And he stormed out of the lecture theater, followed by all his acolytes, and said it was the most appalling thing, it should never have happened, blah, blah, blah. Then the next year, Ridley went to the USA. Okay. And he did surgery. He'd been invited by Derek Vail, who was then one of the great doyens of U.S. ophthalmology. He was the editor of the American Journal of Ophthalmology. And Ridley gave his paper, said what his problems were with it and how he might improve it. And then Derek Vail went for him and was unbelievably unpleasant. He said it was the most appalling thing, it should never have happened. But you know what, Uwe? In the audience was a guy called Warren Rees. And Warren took a different view, and he found Ridley. And he said, Mr. Ridley, have you got a few lenses? Because I'd like to try this. Ridley gave him five lenses, which he took back to Wills. And he flew back in his private plane from Chicago, which is where the academy was. And the next day, he became the second person to implant a lens in the United States.
Wow.
But more than that, he and his sidekick, Turgut Hamdi, published a series of 115 Ridley lenses in 1957. And they published this in the Archives of Ophthalmology. And really, the results weren't bad. They didn't have any lenses dislocate. And the major problem actually initially was inflammation, because the lenses were stored in cetrimide, which they quite soon after that stopped doing. And I actually published a short letter in JCRS earlier in the year, reminding people about this study that they had done. And the sad thing about all of this, which held back implantology for three decades, was that instead of saying this was a terrible idea, they should have turned around to Ridley and said, look, this is actually quite a clever idea. How can we make it better?
Right. Right.
And it just didn't happen. And it was a long, long, hard road. And Cornelis Binkhorst talked about what happened to him in Holland, with people saying it should never have happened. It was a terrible thing. And you could find this across the board with the early IOL adopters. The same thing was true of Phaco.
Right.
And the Welsh Cataract Meeting, which used to take place in Texas, he arranged one year in the 1970s that there should be an open mic session where people who'd had complications with Phaco could come and have 30 seconds to describe what had happened. And there were patients there with weeping eyes and cloudy corneas and goodness knows what. And at that time, there were probably 750 Phaco machines in the USA, most of which were not being used, because surgeons knew that there would be complications or could be complications. They didn't want to get blamed. But sure, patients had heard about this because Charlie Kalman had gone on got quite good at doing fake cover at that stage, but it was a long, hard road. And when Ken Hoffer decided to start the American Implant Society meeting in 1974, it took a while really for things to take off.
Right. So all these technologies that we take for granted, like Phaco or IOLs, there was so much resistance that it took so many even years to just begin to be accepted, let alone widely accepted.
Absolutely. I did a European Phaco tour with Charlie Kalman in 1986. And we did live surgery in six venues. We started in London. We then went to Antwerp. We then went to Munich. We then went to Bologna, and we finished up in Athens. And in 1986, the majority of people in those centers, in fact, almost all of them, were not doing Phaco.
Wow.
And it really wasn't until the end of that decade in the early 90s that it became pretty nearly universal. And certainly in the UK, the move towards Phaco was pushed not by the consultants, it was pushed by the senior residents who went on courses and then taught their bosses how to do Phaco.
Yeah, that's actually, even during my residency, in let's say the mid to late 1990s, I had faculty members, professors who only did extra caps and would ask me to show them how to do some Phaco.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I know when I started doing IOLs with Eric Arnott at Charing Cross, my bosses at Moorfields, at the High Holborn branch, they would ask me to come and into the operating room with them so that I could talk them through putting lenses in. Now, you've got to remember that was before any OVDs.
Right.
So they were putting them in under air bubbles. Most of the time, they were looped lenses, the Binkhorst or Fedorov-type lenses. So you had to be quite good to get the lens in without disturbing the air bubble and damaging the cornea.
Yeah, yeah. So what caused the push to go from being seen as quackery to being accepted as, okay, maybe this is something useful that we should start learning?
Foldable IOLs. Changed the scene completely. Because now people who said, oh, well, there's no point doing Phaco because you have to open the incision to 8 millimeters anyway to do an extra cap. Suddenly, it was a lens that was going through 3.5 millimeters incision.
Right.
And then the benefits of having a small incision, not having induced astigmatism, and then ultimately not having a stitch, and all the other things that came along were really because of that. Now, as you were aware, I got involved in this at a very, very early stage because Eric and I had heard that Eddie Epstein was using a soft material to make IOLs. It was polyhema, but he was doing it with extra caps. So we thought it might be a good idea to see if we could fold a lens and put it into an eye. And I did this with rabbits. So I was actually the first person to fold a lens and stick it in an eye. But it was with a New Zealand white rabbit. We chose those because you get a massive reaction generally. And this material didn't really cause any problems at all. I put quite a lot of them into the anterior chamber just to see what effect it would have on the cornea. And we slaughtered them at 3 months and there was really no effect at all. The problem was that we didn't think like Charlie Kelman. We didn't think to patent the idea. So although I published in August 1981 on this study, because of American patent law, Tom Mazzacco was able to file his patent in February 82 without my study being considered prior art. So if I'd had the royalties and Eric had the royalties, maybe I would have the vineyard in the Sonoma Valley rather than him.
Yeah, back in the day, people don't know. You had ophthalmologists then who were owning these Northern California vineyards.
Bob Sinsky did exactly that.
Right.
Tom was a great guy. He used to bring bottles of his wines to the ASCRS meetings, and he would invite people to dinner and serve his wines, which were very good.
Yeah, that's a whole other one. Yeah, now Sinsky's son runs Sinsky Vineyards.
Yeah. I went to a wonderful birthday party for Bob's 85th at the vineyard. And I mean, there was IOL and Phaco royalty there, and I felt very privileged. I was there with my wife and my two younger children. And we'd had made a holiday out of it, went to Yosemite and all sorts of things. But that was a great party.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, so for the young people may not realize, the only IOLs were these PMA lenses, which were 6 or 7 millimeters in diameter. So even if you did Phaco with a scleral tunnel back then, you're going to have to enlarge your scleral tunnel to 7-8 millimeters just to put the IOL in. So people said, well, let me just do a manual extra cap surgery. I don't need Phaco. Mm-hmm. And then now that you could fold the lens and get it through, say, a 3.5 millimeter incision, now you have a lot more adoption of the Phaco. Now you can actually have less anesthesia. You can have a smaller incision. You can have a corneal incision instead of scleral incision. And now you can have topical anesthesia. So things just got better and better as soon as you got a foldable lens.
Yeah, it was the trigger. And I remember giving the world's results with the Allergan SI18 lens at the EIIC meeting in Copenhagen in 1988. EIIC was the forerunner of the ESCRS. They changed the name in 1990. And the results were really, really good. And in fact, this was the first foldable lens that actually got full FDA approval. It wasn't the star lens, in fact, although you could get it with an IDE. But for general public use, it was the SI18 and SI20 lenses that preceded it.
Yeah, when I was a resident, I used the Allergan SI40 lens. That's the one that we had.
Mm-hmm.
Three-piece silicon optic, and you had to obviously fold it yourself. You had to have the lens folding forceps.
Yes.
The lens folding forceps.
And the best, the lens folding forceps better not be wet or the lens would disappear across the operating room.
Yes, good. They could be slippery too. So right. We had the whole evolution then. So then we had an evolution from the folding forceps to moving over towards injectors.
Well, yes, but interestingly, the original star lens was injected with a cartridge by Tom Mazzacco. And the original videos show him doing exactly that through a 3.5 millimeter incision.
Right.
But I mean, I was involved with other lenses. I was the first person to put an Acrosoft lens in. And in those days, they didn't have an injector for it, so we had to fold the lenses. And it wasn't until Lucio Barato came along with his Barato forceps that we had a really good way of folding that lens and putting it in the eye. And one of the problems with it, with the original version, was that it was really sticky. So if the two halves stuck together, it could take a couple of minutes for the lens to unfold in the eye.
Yeah, right. No, those are all important things. And then we keep evolving. And it's funny how we push the envelope to smaller and smaller and smaller incisions. We even had one lens at a time, which I think is no longer produced, like that goes through a 1 millimeter incision, like a Thinoptics lens. And then, those didn't really work out so well. So now we kind of settled somewhere in the low 2 millimeter range.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I've seen this extraordinary change. But the other thing that didn't quite happen was bimanual Phaco. I mean, I know we've used both hands, but this was the separation of Fakertip and the irrigating chopper. And this was really brought about because of the sovereign Faker that introduced White Star in 2001. And this was a new way of delivering Faker power, whereby you could have microsecond pockets of Faker power separated by microsecond pockets of nothing, which was pulsing. And we went through enormous gyrations to decide what was the best ratio between on and off. And they all had alphabet letters after them. And I got most confused, and we all did. And in the end, we came down to, I think it was called EF or something like that, which then became the product.
Right.
But it meant that although Amar Agarwal decided to do this early on, if you look at his early videos, the assistant was sent there with a fire extinguisher, basically to try and keep the wound where the Faker tip was cool enough so that it didn't get a change in the collagen. With White Star, which was then followed by all the other manufacturers to produce something similar, the heating of the tip was pretty mild, and it certainly did not get to 45 degrees Celsius, which is where the collagen denatures and changes, and you get that horrible white change in the wound when you've got a wound burn.
Right. Yeah, that's the whole the advent of Faco power modulations, burst mode and pulse mode and variable duty cycles and all these kind of things. That was a very novel idea, because before that, none of that existed.
No, indeed not. I remember when the first Faco machine came along, it actually had linear power. That was the CooperVision 9001. And that was a huge change of it. Before that, you had three settings. And as soon as you went from foot position two to foot position three, you got full on whatever Faco power you were using. And the machines were not very efficient. So most of the time it was 100% power.
So it was an on-off switch instead of an ability to linearly decide how much you want.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, big changes. And then by manual Faco, I remember I even tried it. I tried it for 100, 200 cases. Wasn't in love with it.
I did quite a lot of it. The last time I did it at live surgery was at ESCRS in Berlin in 2008. But by then, I was very much using much smaller tips and using a 1.8 millimeter incision. So there was really no point in going down that route.
Right. And then obviously that changed the Faco dynamics, because as we went to smaller infusion with the bimanual, you had your infusion chopper, your irrigating chopper. That's why back then we had even gravity for the bottle, for the infusion pressure. So we had these huge bottle heights, like your ceiling wasn't tall enough in the room.
Yeah. Well, the person who started that was, what's his name? Japanese guy who does the pre-chop.
Akahoshi,
that's right. I remember seeing him in his theater with his bottle practically on the story above him. It must have been about 250 centimeters up or something extraordinary, because that gave him enough fluid going through so he could use a 1.8 millimeter incision.
Right.
And good dynamics in the eye.
Well, that's an important thing. You were also very good about teaching scores of ophthalmologists the Faco dynamics and the fluid.
I've been giving that talk now for 35 years, and it gets updated on a regular basis. But it's very funny. I mean, you will know, Uday, how many of our colleagues don't actually know that much about Faker dynamics. And I remember being giving a course in the UK with David Allen and Brian Little, and it was supposedly an advanced course, but I gave a Faker dynamics talk anyway. Before I gave the talk, we asked the senior consultants who were there, first of all, what sort of pumps they had on their machines. And 70% of them said peristaltic. Then we asked them which machine they had, and 50% of them were using the Bausch & Lomb machine, which of course is a Venturi pump. It certainly gave us some amusement.
Yeah, I think it's so important to understand actually the physics behind it. Then it makes sense, right? How the pump types make a difference, line compliance, venting. All these things that are very important to get that stability in the anterior chamber and keep the capsule stable.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I remember giving a course to senior theater nurses, and I asked them whether when the rep came to fit the machine up, that anybody had actually changed the settings since he left, and nobody put their hands up.
Right. Yeah, I used to tell my residents when I was teaching at UCLA, I'd say, The correct way of choosing settings is understanding them, not copying the senior resident and not copying the sales rep.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Then you can change it on the fly. Now, also tell us about the Packard FACO tip. That was a very great advancement for us.
Well, I wanted to have I wanted to do 1.8 millimeter incision for coaxial FACO. And I went to Alcon and I said, will you make me a 22 gauge Kelman tip? And they said, no. So I went to MST and I spoke to them and they said, yes. And they were happy to do it and has my name on. I have no financial interest in it, unfortunately. And what it does, if you put it in the eye, you will be astonished at how much more room you appear to have there by having this needle. And the thing that MST did, which is really interesting, it's got a very thin wall. So the internal diameter, which is governing the way that the fluidics will behave because of Poiseuille's law, will actually give you the similar settings as if it was a 21 gauge.
Oh, interesting.
So you're getting more bangs for your buck, as it were. And it cuts really well because of its narrow profile. So with a dense cataract, if you want to do a little bit of sculpting, start with, it's like a hot knife through butter.
Right. Of course. Yeah. Smaller tip. That thin wall is important, right? Poiseuille's equations, radius to the fourth power is what's going to determine the flow. And yeah. So as you change that radius, it's really important to not make the radius too small. So if you thin out the walls, then you still get a little bit more radius.
Yeah, that's true.
For sure. And then even then techniques can evolve, right? You evolve from that towards like your soft chop technique. Could you explain that for us?
Yes. One of the things that people don't realize when you're chopping is that you have to have a good grip of the nucleus. And if you've got even a 2+ nucleus, if you have a full power and full vacuum and flow setting, when you try and hold onto it to do your chop, you'll find that actually, if you're not careful, you'll come through the other side. Mm. So the soft chop is very simple. It means using a sculpting setting to hold the nucleus. So 75 millimeters of mercury will mean that there is a finger of nucleus going into the tip, which is not being sucked up because the vacuum is relatively low. So it means that you've got good purchase on the nucleus and you can just do your normal chop maneuver, whether it's horizontal or vertical, and it won't come apart. Oh, sorry, the tip won't come away when you don't want it to. So that's what I would, that's what I taught. As far as the really soft ones, I have a technique which I've used for 30 years called soft slice. And what this involves is making a very small area of opening in the center of the soft nucleus with your FACO tip, and then taking a relatively blunt instrument. And I use a McCool Iris repositor, which I then go out to the periphery and just stroke towards the center, gradually going a little bit deeper, a little bit deeper, so that you've got a trench, a very narrow trench. And then I move it round and do that several times until I've done it 4 times. Then what you can do is that you push down into the trench with the FACO tip and the chopper device or the repositor. Push them down towards the center and then just push them apart. Now, the thing is, it doesn't have to be a complete split. Because it's a soft cataract, all you need to do is to get about a half to two-thirds split, because then you change to your high vacuum settings. You go out and allow the vacuum to build. You've got your auditory feedback from the FACO machine that tells you you've got full occlusion, and you just pull it towards you. Right. And you just do this 4 times, and it's what I used for my refractive lens exchange patients. It works very well.
Yeah, I'm always surprised at the number of even modern day cataract surgeons who are still doing like divide and conquer and not moving towards these chop techniques. It just really was very surprising to me.
It's really common still in Europe.
Right.
A lot of people are not chopping.
I've never met a surgeon who learned how to do FACO chop who then said, nah, I'm going to go back to just doing divide and conquer. I never met one ever.
I'm absolutely with you on that.
So, but you're right, it is more challenging because like if you're doing a divide and conquer, there's no kind of time constraint. But as you said earlier, like with a soft lens, you're doing your soft chop, because if you go in with a high vacuum, you have a second before that piece of lens breaks off and now you lose your occlusion, you lose your purchase. So I like the idea of the lower vacuum on a soft lens, you can hold on to that piece better.
Absolutely. And the other thing, going back to divide and conquer, which is really important when you're teaching people to do that, because I normally would start teaching residents that before, and we would then move on to Stop and Shop and then onto Full Shop, is to remember the shape of the nucleus. So right. that when you get beyond the halfway point, you don't keep going in the same direction. You do that with your hands, come up the other side. And I've seen many young people at the start, before they realize this, going all the way through and coming out the other side just where they don't want to.
Yes, for sure. Well, I kind of copied your teaching methods. When I was professor at UCLA for 22 years, I did the same thing. Start with a bite and conquer, then Stop and Chop, and then let's try to learn chop. And even then, only maybe a quarter of the residents learn chop. And again, yeah, my analogy was like yours. I said the nucleus is like an M&M. It's going to be thicker in the middle and much thinner out in the periphery.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So yeah, all these little pearls. And, you know, I guess what people sometimes don't realize too is that none of this stuff was taught to us, even my generation. In residency, yeah, you're doing FACO, but no one's doing chop at the time. So you got to learn all this on your own. And especially for you, well, you didn't learn any of this stuff. You had to learn IOLs and FACO and any new techniques. You got to be self-taught to a degree.
But one of the things that you've done today with your cataractcoach.com is you brought wonderful videos to a huge audience, which has enabled people to see what all of these various and sundry techniques are, and then go back and think about it and maybe try it in the wet lab or something like that, so that they feel that, okay, if somebody out there is doing this, I can do that too.
Right. For sure. I mean, that was the goal of it. It's the way I learn. I make videos that I want to watch. So that's how I know they're interesting, right? So if I'd watch, and that's also why they're kind of short, you know, 5 minutes a day max, that's all you need.
Well, these days we have a very low attention span. So you know, it's not surprising.
Well, it's funny you say that, because I put the same video every day on many platforms. So mm-hmm. it's all automated now. So the same video goes to YouTube, it goes to Cataract Coach, it goes to Facebook, LinkedIn, and Instagram. Instagram, though, has been my fastest growth. Today, Instagram gets just about maybe a little bit more views per month than YouTube.
Really?
Catches on Instagram, on YouTube, the video is in portrait mode. I don't know, it's in landscape mode.
Yep.
And in YouTube, I have 30 seconds to get someone's attention before I see the decay and they go away. Instagram, I'm going to edit the same video in portrait mode because the phone's held vertically, and I have 3 seconds to get your attention. Otherwise, you swipe away.
Wow, I never thought of it that way.
Yeah, so I've done the analysis. I study this like it's science here. So I look at what's my decay rate, what's my swipe rate, how long people watch the video, the retention rates. I look at all this stuff. And so now when I edit the same video, I have to do a second edit for Instagram, and I got to cut right to the good part within 3 seconds. Otherwise, they're gone. So it's so crazy.
That's deeply sad, actually, that it's got to that stage, that people are getting rid of stuff so quickly that they don't really get into it properly.
Well, I think
it's like the time it takes to get into a Victorian novel. You know, the first 50 pages you've got to get through before you get to the good stuff.
Right. In fact, you know what? Interesting. There was an article I read recently that Netflix is having a problem that now people will watch like one episode of a series and then they're done. Mm-hmm. Attention spans are declining. And I think a lot of it has to do with the way we're just keep tapping that dopamine hit from social media. And social media wants to propel you to do more and more and more and more. So it's a little bit crazy.
I try and avoid social media apart from WhatsApp. But that's just sort of keeping the family under control. And we have a WhatsApp group for the neighbors and that sort of thing. But the rest of it, forget it.
Yeah, I know. It's tough. But I mean, the nice part is, boy, I can get the message out fast. You talk about true peer review.
Mm-hmm.
I put up on Instagram, I can put up a short video and a vote. And vote, what would you do here? A, B, C, D.
Right.
I can get 2,000 ophthalmologists voting on this in 24 hours.
That's impressive.
It's unbelievable.
Mm.
So, I mean, and then on it, but you know, it's funny, most it's watched even more than that. My Instagram now gets about 100,000 views a day. So about 3 million a month. So it's bananas numbers.
Mm.
And all the comments that you read, clearly you're ophthalmologist, because it's all ophthalmology. You're not, you don't know these words, this language, if you're not in ophthalmology. But it is really quite amazing. But yeah, maybe we need to push back towards a little bit longer videos.
No, I mean, I can see, when I put stuff up on LinkedIn, and I know that you can't really go much beyond 5 minutes or you've lost them.
Right. But I think, you know, so now when I put on the Instagram video, which is only about maybe a minute or less, I'll have a little small text at the top. This is just a clip. Please see the full video on YouTube or cataractcoach.com. So hopefully some will then, okay, spend the effort to kind of learn it. So now a lot of people, I ask young people when I meet them, oh, so do you watch on YouTube or Insta? They say Insta. I said, do you ever go from Insta to YouTube then to see the full video? They're like, yeah, sometimes. So it's a challenge.
Well, at the moment, I'm involved with two initiatives with ESCRS. One is the Complex Cataract Surgery Masterclass,
right,
which I commissioned all the videos for. And we have 50 young people this year who will see videos. And then after the 3 weeks, we will have a webinar where they can we can review all the questions they've posed to us. And on the other side, we're inaugurating this year the Basic Phaco Skills School.
Nice.
And all of the lectures we have there are they come to London, which is where ESCRS is this year. They will have dedicated time in wet labs and dry labs and also on simulators. And at the end of all that, they'll get an MCQ exam to make sure that they paid attention and a certificate to prove to somebody in their unit that they actually did something useful. Because the sad thing is, as you well know, in Europe particularly, an awful lot of countries really don't provide adequate surgical training or any at all.
Right. Right. Yeah, I've met young residents or registrars who say, yeah, I'm in this country or another, and for 4 years, I'll look over shoulders. I won't do a single phaco in 4 years. Said,
very sad. Yeah. There was an article in JCRS about this about 18 months ago. And I stick my hand up and say the UK was shown to be the best in terms of surgical training. The next came Portugal and then Ireland. And then after that, things drifted off pretty quickly. And so even countries like Germany and France and Italy do not provide routine surgical training for their residents.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. Wow. That's really unfortunate. But there's a thirst for the knowledge, and boy, we're trying to provide it. I like the way you're doing with the complex cases. That's actually very smart.
I gathered together 30 videos from a whole bunch of colleagues. They were happy to do it. They got a little honorarium for their privilege. But no, they're really good quality. And the feedback that we've had, because what we do is we ask them 3 months after they've done the complex cataract surgery course, how much it's changed the way that they view the surgery they do, what surgery they do, and how it's increased their confidence. And it's been really positive.
Right. Well, especially like you focus on, here's a complication, here's a misstep, here's what we learned from it.
Yes. Well, if you come to London to ESCRS, we've got a new venture that Burkhard and I are running called Brave Cases, where people put in a little bit as we used to do before, but this time we'll have a whole panel of people in interrogating the various surgeons who put themselves forward, where stuff didn't quite go according to plan, and then the audience will be able to vote on whether they think that how they got themselves out of the brown stuff was the right way to go.
Brave Kate, I will be at ESCRS for sure in London, so I will certainly look it up.
Monday afternoon.
Brave Cases. That sounds like a fantastic session. Yeah, that's, I love it. Yeah, ESCRS has become one of my absolute favorite meetings. That meeting just grown and grown and grown. It's amazing.
It's huge now. I mean, last year we had in Copenhagen over 10,000 doctors.
Right.
From 130 countries.
Yeah, I think my American colleagues are sleeping on it, though, unfortunately, because the last ESCRS in Copenhagen, there were more Brazilian surgeons there than Americans. Come on, Americans. What are we doing here?
Well, you all love London. Come to London. We'll be happy to see you.
I'll be there for you. I haven't missed an ESCRS in many years. So, no, I love it. I'll definitely be there. I'll do my best to cataract coach 90-minute sessions, which will be fast and fun. But I think that is the best way of learning. I mean, the showing the complications, showing the missteps and saying, hey, you know what? Here's what we should have done better.
Well, dear Bobby was the one who really initiated this. Who was the first person, actually Bobby Osher, to show complications and to put his hand on a heart and say, look, this is what happened.
Right.
It happened to you. I can guarantee you at some point, this is what I did about it.
Yeah, Bob Osher is the godfather of ophthalmic surgical video. I love the man. I've learned so much from him. Owe him a debt of gratitude.
Unfortunately, he will not be with us in London, because he's got a little bit of cardiac arrhythmia. So Mike Snyder will be coming to do his session on Saturday afternoon in London. But Bobby's done all the hard work of editing all the videos that were submitted to him.
Oh, that's fair. Yeah, always a great session. Always good to learn from. Let's talk about a few other kind of great pros, which I liked from you, which was the one was prophylactic globe decompression. So when you have those real tight eyes, that was such a big deal. In the old days, people may not know, there was the Honan balloon, which if you're under age 50, you probably don't know what that is.
No, it was a thing you strapped around the eye, and then you blew it up with a little hand pump. And the idea was to compress the orbit so that you would lower the pressure in the eye, and there would, the weaker orbital pressure would also go. And this was important, really, for extracaps rather than phaco.
Yeah.
And if you're talking about decompressing the globe, I think you're probably talking about doing it with medication.
Mannitol, right.
Yeah. And mannitol is great. And particularly if you've got a nanophobic eye or a very short eye, you want to try and limit the amount of vitreous pressure that there is there. So if you're going to use mannitol, use 20%, 250 mils, 30 minutes before that patient is going to be operated on. The reason that you need to do it 30 minutes is because it has to have time to affect, but you mustn't leave it too long or you'll have a patient on the table bursting to pass water. So it's absolutely critical to get the timing right, but it does have a useful effect, no question.
Yeah, if we give mannitol, we wait the 30 minutes, and right before we go to the operating theater, here's the bathroom, the restroom. Please empty your bladder.
Yeah, really important, particularly if it's going to be a complex case, which it can be very much so. I mean, some of the most difficult cases you will come across are those short eyes with shallow chambers.
Anytime I see a case that has an axial length of less than 20 millimeters, I just think, can I send this to someone else? I just don't want to do this.
And I must admit that the first time I actually dropped a nucleus in my phaco career was 27 years after I started doing phaco. And this was a nanophthalmic eye, and everything was coming out of all the incisions. So I thought, okay, I'll try and do a little bit of vitrectomy. The only problem was, I didn't realize when I did the vitrectomy, is they also clipped the back of the posterior capsule.
Yeah.
And as soon as I went in, the hydrogen section, interesting, was fine. But as soon as I went in with the phaco, the nucleus disappeared south.
Yeah, the infusion pressure pushes it back, and then the capsule splits open. Yeah, that's the problem. These nanophthalmic guys, where is pars plana? The anatomy's so crazy, you don't even know. So when you're trying to do a little bit of vitreous decompression, you may not be in the right spot for that eye.
It very often is only 1 millimeter. And you don't know you're going to hit it at all. And so having had that experience, I would try and do almost everything else with those eyes, particularly mannitol, probably massaging the globe, using high viscosity OVDs like Helon 5, making very tiny incisions, so that maybe do your capsulotomy through a side port rather than through the main wound. Anything to stop the iris and everything else coming out of the incisions when you don't want them to.
Yeah, I had a case recently, very high hyperopic patient, +8 of hyperopia, wearing glasses full time. Do this very stressful surgery, and it just goes very well. I'm so happy. Post-op, the patient's refraction is about +0.5, +0.5. Wow. And I think the patient, you should be thrilled. The patient's like, yeah, thank you. I can see, but everything looks so small now.
Oh, Uday, as a high myope, when I eventually get around to get my cataracts done, everything is going to look so large for me.
Right. You're right. But it's the patient, because of the glasses, they're one of these +8s. Everything's so magnified. And I was like, no, your glasses were wrong. This is the correct image size. The patient's like, I don't know. Everything just looks small. All right, okay, let's put the cataract back in. Okay, let's do that. Now, you brought your teaching to many, many countries. You've been a big world traveler for ophthalmology.
Yeah, I've lectured in 64 countries so far.
That's amazing. Now, what cross-cultural lessons have you learned here? For me, it's kind of like, no matter where I go, all ophthalmologists are pretty similar. We're very similar people.
By and large, I think that's fair enough. The very fact that so many nations will send people to ESCRS, and we all enjoy each other's company while we're there. I mean, one of the things that's been wonderful for me is that because of all the people that I've visited all over the world, I've got friends everywhere.
Right. Yeah.
And that's then you meet up with them at the meetings because they're coming to the meetings as well. So it's a real joy.
Yeah, it really is. You realize how small of a world ophthalmology actually is.
And the other thing is, you've taught so many people, as I have, is when residents come up to you at meetings and say, "Hi, Mr. Packard," or "Hi, Richard. Do you know what? I can hear your voice in my head when I get into difficulties, and you will have explained to me how I can get out of it again."
Right.
And
right.
It's a nice, warm, sort of fuzzy feeling when that happens. I'm sure you will have had exactly the same experience.
Absolutely. So I know that's super important. Now you've also been super involved with the ESCRS video competition, which is one of my favorite parts of the whole meeting. And you've been doing that for like 20 something years.
Yeah, I became a judge in 1999, and I became the chief judge in 2000. And I announced that next year will be my last year. I shall be 80 years old in February. And although I will carry on with teaching if anybody wants me to go and teach them, this is a big thing. This year, ESCRS video competition, we had 365 entries.
Wow.
That was way more than last year, which was 290.
Right.
And it's become a huge burden now. So we're recruiting more judges because in the first round of the judging, because we do it in three rounds, I had 107 videos to mark.
107. Wow, that's a lot of work.
It is, and the length they can be, the maximum is 8 minutes. The majority of them, on average, are about 5-6 minutes. But it's still a lot to do because you want to look at them more than once. We have an elaborate marking system. Then the second round, the top five in each of our categories of prize winning is then viewed by all the judges because. The first round is just the videos are just reviewed by three judges. Okay. And then finally, when that marking has been done, they all come to my house where I've got a big screen and a projector and so on. And we then award the prizes. And potentially there are three prizes awarded in each category. Very often we don't award all of them because we like to keep the standards up.
Sure.
And we want people who get a prize to know that they're getting a prize because it's a really good video.
Right. Yeah. Now with everything being, the video is so accessible now. I've had videos submitted to me on Cataract Coach where they say, "Well, I just use the assistant oculars and I got this, you know, mold off of Amazon and I can just mount my cell phone camera there and now you can get video, you get high def video."
Absolutely. Yeah.
So it's a lot more accessible now to everyone. When you're watching these videos, what kind of separates something that's, wow, truly a great teaching video or truly great innovation from just like, okay, it's an interesting case?
I think it's actually fairly obvious. One, we want them to be attractive to look at. So there's, right. there's a score for artistic merit and so on and so forth. We also want them to be educational. But there's a whole category of educational videos. There is a category of innovative videos. There's a category of scientific videos. There's a category of residence and training videos, and there's a category of special and difficult cases videos. So they all have different criteria. But by and large, when you've been judging as long as I have, you know pretty soon on that, hey, this is above the average. This is really going to be a prize winner.
Right. No, I absolutely agree with you. My only pet peeve is when they make the video and then they put copyrighted music into it. I'm like, no, don't do that.
Well, we're bringing a new thing in next year for when you submit. First of all, you have to press a button to say that you have included a financial disclosure.
Okay.
You also have to press a button to say that you have no images or video or music to which you do not have the rights. And thirdly, that you press a button to say that you have put a narration on video, because the number of videos we get with no narration is huge.
Oh, yeah, that defeats the purpose even.
It does, yeah. So hopefully, once they've done all that, and then they then press submit, that they will have a video that we will actually find worth watching.
Well, then hopefully next year it won't be 360. Maybe it'll be a little bit fewer, maybe half the number. I think it's more manageable.
We're also limiting people to one video only, not two.
Yeah, I mean, with that many videos, gosh, let's say you've got a tremendous amount of work. You're talking about dozens of hours, if not 50 hours. I mean, to be a judge there, it's a huge time commitment.
It is. This is why we're trying to rationalize it. Because the trouble is that a lot of people put a video in and then that they use as a justification to their department for them to attend the meeting. And an awful lot of videos that we had, I think probably 50% of them, were not really worth watching at all.
So yeah, it'd be nice. When you have those three checkboxes, I think that'll hopefully cut down some of the submissions that are not truly worthy of the contest.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's a great idea. Do you have all those, are all the videos of, like, the winners, are they available online?
They are, yes. They're always available to members of ESCRS.
Gotcha.
In ESCRS On Demand. And we've got a new hub, a new learning hub now, which has amalgamated a whole load of different things. And members can now get a login there, and they have access to so many recordings of this, that, and the other, of lectures, of papers, of courses, of videos, of everything you can think of will be available to them to look at and have as teaching aids.
I think that's fantastic. Yeah, we've seen, ESCRS has grown every year for the last many, many years. And that's actually, in comparison to a lot of other meetings, especially some USA meetings, where attendance is declining.
Yeah, I think there are a number of issues here. One of them is politics.
Yeah.
A lot of people who come from countries that are developing countries and so on, or the Middle East or whatever, aren't necessarily welcome in the USA.
Yeah.
And when I stopped going to ASCRS a while ago because I felt I wasn't actually getting anything there that I wasn't able to get at the ESCRS meetings. And I know a lot of people from outside Europe come to ESCRS because they feel they're getting more for their money, as it were.
Right. I think I get a lot out of the meeting. I really do. I mean, the content there is really quite good. I always make myself a pretty packed schedule.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
So it's an intense few days. Now, you're also involved with as an examiner for the European Board of Ophthalmology.
This is a specialist exam called the FEBOS-CR. So the Fellowship, the European Board of Ophthalmology Specialist Exam in Cataract Refractive Surgery.
Mm.
And we initiated, this is now going to be our sixth iteration this year. I was involved with reviewing MCQ questions yesterday evening. And one thing we've discovered, which I'm sure you're well aware of, is when you're setting MCQ questions, you've got to have somebody there whose first language is English.
Yeah.
Because the nuances that we can see in the way that people have worded a question can be potentially dubious for somebody that looks at this and they think, what on earth are they talking about?
Yeah, it can be. Yeah, I get it. It can be a little tough with, especially the language barrier sometimes.
Mm. Yeah, because there's got to be no doubt that there's only one answer. It's either true or false.
Right. Now for FEBOS-CR, cataract refractive, is this a written exam? Is it oral? Is it both?
It's a multiple exam. There's an MCQ paper, which is 250 answers to 50 questions.
Okay.
Then there is a big oral component. So in order to become eligible, you have to have submitted what you consider to be a complex case with a video of cataract surgery. That is then fed back to you as part of the oral exam, where you have to justify what you felt about that particular case to examiners.
Oh, interesting.
You'll also be shown an unseen video when you are taking on the role of a teacher, describing what was happening in this case that was done by one of your trainees to another trainee. There will also be your ability to look at and critique a paper. And finally, I think what the final one is a case presentation that you also have to talk about. And in all of those, there will be a 5-point scale. So 5 is excellent, 4 is a clear pass, 3 is a maybe pass, maybe fail, 2 is a fail, and then 1 is forget it.
what percent of people who attempt the exam end up passing everything?
It's got better. The first time we had a 30% pass rate. It's a really tough exam.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. On the exam board, there are a number of colleagues from Europe, and the Brits were there as well. Surgeons, an ophthalmology exam that I took in 1976, there was a 30% pass rate. Wow. If you were doing the primary fellowship for the College of Surgeons exam, which we, all surgeons had to do, the pass rate there first time was 10%.
10? Wow. Straight.
It took me three goes to get that that exam. The final part of the ophthalmology FRCS, I did in one go. But you ask anybody of a particular vintage in the UK about the primary, and they will groan.
Wow, that's rough. Because in the US, I think the American Board of Ophthalmology exam, I think it's probably 80, 90% pass on the written right first time. And then the oral is probably like 70% pass the first time.
Well, we're up to 50% now. This is partly because initially, a lot of people didn't realize you needed to do some work for this exam. There's a young lady who's originally from Ireland who now is a professor in Belgium. And she, alongside a lot of her senior Belgian colleagues, took the exam the first time round. She was the only one who passed because they hadn't done any work at all. They'd just taken for granted because they were seen.
Wow. Maybe I should take the exam. Yeah, I said, maybe I should try to take the exam, but I will study a lot in advance. I don't want to be embarrassed.
There's a big debate at the moment, which the exam board for ESCRS, we want to push this exam out to people not in Europe. Yeah. But the EBO are not so keen on this. It's silly because FRCS off is examined all over the world. It is done in Hong Kong. It's done in Singapore. It's done in Kuala Lumpur. It's done in all sorts of places.
Sure.
So that the local residents can get this qualification.
Right.
Why FEBOS CR shouldn't be done elsewhere.
Well, I'll certainly volunteer to come to Europe and take it. I'll try. What the heck? I'll look into this.
But we'll again, give you honorary post as a European ophthalmologist. Then you can do it.
I will study a lot. I don't want to be embarrassed. With a 50-50 pass rate, you never know.
No, well, one of the things is in the MCQ, there is some negative marking. So you have to answer every question. Either you put true or you put false or you put don't know. Don't know is a zero. Put true or false and you get it wrong, then you lose half a point.
Oh, there's a penalty for it. So if you get it wrong, it's not zero. It's a minus. Right.
You can't game it.
Oh, it's interesting. That's a different approach for sure. I didn't even think of that.
We've been told now by people who know about exams that we can't do this anymore because it's too stressful for the candidates.
Nah, come on, no such thing. I'll volunteer to take it. Come on.
Yeah, it's actually very useful because it means people concentrate. They just don't take it for granted that getting a wrong answer is not a bad thing. Because if you don't do that, you can game it. You can get 50% just by marking them all true.
Right. Yeah. If it's all two false questions, for sure. For sure. What do you think is coming in the next 10 years for FACO? If you're going to get.
I think fluidics have probably got about as good as they can get. The new machines like the Unity have taken things to a new level. Chambers are so stable. I mean, I would have adored this when I started doing FACO. Residents now don't realize how lucky they are to have these wonderful machines, which means that it's actually very unusual now to get a bust capsule. So that's one thing. The IOLs are going from strength to strength in terms of what you can do on an optic. But the next thing that I'm sure will come will be a true accommodative lens.
Yeah.
What I don't think, though, is that it will be done by changing the shape the way that it's done now by squeezing fluid here, there, and everywhere. I think this is something that's going to be done electronically.
Sure.
It will be a smart lens that will be put into the eye that will instinctively know what focal length you want it to be.
Okay, like holding something here in front of now, yeah. Focus.
It's a bit like the device that you can put onto a pair of glasses when you want to know what sort of lens you should be implanting in somebody who wants a simultaneous vision lens, whether they should be getting a trifocal or a DOF lens or an enhanced monofocal. And you give this to them for a week, and then suddenly you can find out that actually they're reading over here somewhere, they're not reading up here. So you need to give them a different sort of lens. I think the other thing that's going to happen without question is robotics.
Right.
It's already starting to see this. And because robotics are so good now with micro tolerances of what you're doing, and because all the machinery is so good, and because you can do the capsulotomy with lasers, as you know, I'm interested in one of the lasers that does this. And then you can divide up the nucleus with a femtosecond laser, and then you can use the machine that is probably mounted specially outside the eye to make all the maneuvers that it needs to make.
Right.
Because it's learned how to do this. A bit like the lawnmower that you have on your lawn that is a robot that goes around the edge of your lawn without going off the edge. I mean, if you can do that with a lawnmower, there's no reason why you can't do it with a phaco machine.
Yeah, I was last year in October, I was honored to be the surgeon for Horizon Surgical Systems.
Oh, really?
I was there with the world's first robotic cataract surgery in humans.
Wonderful. I bet that was exciting.
A little nerve-wracking because we did a series of 10 and they said, hey, we just need 10 to be 10 perfect cases. No adverse events. And I said, understood, don't worry. So it's really amazing what the work the engineers have done and how even in the last year, the robots even evolved more. The things are changing so quickly.
Well, it's like all the electronic stuff, all the chips getting faster and faster. Now, there was a piece in the latest Economist magazine as to whether Moore's law was now obsolete. Now, Moore's law was based on the idea that the amount of stuff you could get onto a chip would double every year.
Yeah.
And we've gone way beyond that now.
Right. Yeah, no, it's the change is very, very rapid. And now integration, as you said, first we have very, very fine micron level control. Mm-hmm. So the best I can do with my hand is maybe 40 microns. Robot can do 5 or less. And then reaction times, you can be an F1 race car driver and have 180 millisecond reaction time. The robot can be 5 milliseconds. So just unbelievable.
But if you look at not just at our field, but for example, hip replacement. By the robot and lets him use it. And that's down to microns.
Yeah. Yeah, it's absolutely neat stuff. The one thing I wanted to ask you about with fluidics is, I know there's a big push recently to use lower infusion pressure, physiologic.
Yeah.
I don't like operating at 20 millimeters of mercury. I'd much rather put it at 40 to finish the case. And I think it's a much more stable eye and you have a lower incidence of problems. Am I a stick in the mud?
Particularly. But I mean, I with my Centurion, when I was still doing surgery, I had it at 30 millimeters of mercury. And one of the first things you'll discover then is that actually makes you into a better surgeon is the eye is much softer. So that, for example, if you had your, with the Infinity, if you had your bottle height at 110 centimeters, that eye has a pressure of 85.
Right.
So it's like a rock. So you can move around inside the incision, the side port and the phaco incision, and it will not distort the eye.
Right.
Try that at 30 or even 20. You're distorting the eye really quickly. So it makes you into a better surgeon because it means that your movements are actually much more focused.
Right. Yeah, no, I that makes sense. But I had a case coming up on Cataract Coach where the young registrar resident was using 20 millimeters mercury infusion pressure, ends up causing a small hole in the posterior capsule. Well, the problem is the vitreous cavity pressure was higher than 20.
Yeah.
So now you instantly get vitreous prolapse. Whereas if you had a infusion pressure of 40, you would not have.
Now, I'm going to ask you a question.
Sure.
At what point in your phaco do you take out the side port instrument?
I use it in what I call the safe position. I put my chopper smooth side downwards towards the bag. So as I take out that last nuclear quadrant, I prevent the bag from coming up.
Right. Try taking it out long before that. And what happens is there's no leakage out of your side port. The chamber deepens, the bag fills and moves away from you. And that last piece of nucleus that is coming to will come directly to your phaco tip because there's no extra fluid going out the side port.
Right. Now, there are two schools of thought there.
I know.
My side port first is not very leaky. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is my chopper tip is also designed so that the tip of it, not the chopping tip, but the arm of it, gets larger in diameter as it goes towards the para.
No, I see that.
So
just try it the other way. And when I start juniors doing this, when I start, they say, oh, you can't do that. I say, just try it. And they suddenly see that the pieces of nucleus come directly to the phaco tip because there's nowhere else for them to go because your side pole wound is closed. And everything just deepens.
Yeah. No, it makes sense because you're taking away that one extra source of outflow. So now your inflow is a little bit better.
Yeah.
So if you were going to give, I can't believe we've been talking for already an hour. if you're going to give one great bit of closing advice to a young ophthalmologist, registrar, resident, fellow, just about to start their full career, what would that advice be?
Oh, very simple. And this is one of the things that Eric Arnott taught me when I went to work with him. He said, Richard, he said, analyze every single part of the procedure and ask yourself why you do it the way you do it and what instruments are actually required to do what you need to do. And what this essentially means is, yes, you've analyzed everything, but you probably will reduce the number of instruments that you use down to half a dozen at the absolute maximum. You don't want to have a tray that covers the whole of the trolley. And the nurse is fumbling around trying to find the bit that you think you want. And I think it's part of what I've done a video, which I might send to you, called How to Think Like a Surgeon.
Okay.
It's a bit long for you. It's about 15 minutes. Having technical errors, how you can avoid having cognitive errors, and how you should approach every single case that you do so that you are giving the best possible outcome for your patient.
Oh, that's like that. That's great. If you send me the video, I'm happy to feature it on Cataract Coach. You'll get tens of thousands of views instantly. It's crazy.
It's one of the videos which is in the Complex Masterclass and also in the Basic Skills School.
Well, if you'd like to share it, I'm happy to feature it. Or even you can just give us a link. I can put a link down below in the podcast description.
So I will do that when we're done.
All right, perfect. Well, again, I want to thank you so much for the last hour chatting with me. It's been really informative.
Well, it's been such fun, Udan. Thank you so much for asking me.
My pleasure. Well, remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we've got a new Cataract Coach podcast every Sunday on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google. Wherever you find a podcast, of course, you find the Cataract Coach podcast. We also have a new Cataract Coach video every single day. Now we're at more than 3,000 days in a row and counting. So until next time, I'll catch you later.